to its lookout post. Mon Dieu, he is intimidating, isn't he? I suspect he even charges the dogs protection money. She spoke fluent Italian, but with a really strong French accent. Having eyed Poldy for a moment, she laughed again as if that brief inspection had proved thoroughly satisfactory, and extended her hand.
Valérie, Reissi di Belfiore. Call me Valérie.
Isolde Oberreiter. Poldy for short.
What was that funny language you were speaking just now?
Bavarian.
Ah, you're German.
It's a bit more complicated than that.
I'd never have known it from your Italian. But, mon Dieu, I'm the last person to judge. I've lived here since I was 20, but everyone keeps telling me, "Don't worry, signorina. Another few months and your Italian will improve a lot."
The girl laughed again, something she did almost as often as she said, "Mon Dieu." Impulsively, like an old friend, she took Poldy by the arm.
"But why are we standing around out here? Would you like a coffee? Then you can tell me what friendly tide has washed you up on these shores."
Valérie led Poldy into the house, which was cool and shadowy and redolent of dust, books, mothballs, and the luxuriant sprigs of jasmine she distributed around the interior in numerous vases. Time seemed suddenly to slow, as if compelled to find its way through scented oil. A dog barked somewhere, but that was all that could be heard of the outside world. The interior of the pink house, too, seemed timeless, abraded by the centuries, but in almost pristine condition. The floor was tiled with pale terracotta and black basalt. Here and there, colourful mosaics glowed beneath the worn carpets. The ceilings displayed shimmering floral ornamentation, pallid nymphs and their attendant forms cavorting through tropical scenery, peacocks fanning out their tails, cranes soaring over misty landscapes and patches of mildew. Huge krakens, dolphins, and glittering goatfish cruised a mythical ocean populated by water sprites and sirens, and a lustful cyclops leered down at my speechless aunt from behind the slopes of Etna.
"Well, tickle my arse with a feather,"
Poldy exclaimed in German, and in Italian,
"this house is sheer magic."
Delightedly, Valérie laid the espresso jug aside and showed Poldy a guest room that had once been the family chapel. Although plaster was flaking off the vaulted ceiling, luminous frescoes depicting the Garden of Eden and the expulsion of Adam and Eve could still be seen between the mould patches.
"Last year I had a dowser to stay," said Valérie. "A German who said he'd never detected such a charge of positive energy anywhere else."
Hanging throughout the house were gloomy old portraits of the former residents of Femina Morta. Melancholy youths, old men with spiteful eyes, and powdered belles encased in corsets and silken gowns.
"Voilà, my paternal ancestors, the Reissi di Belfiores," Valérie explained. "Bourbons, cowards, whoremongers and visionaries, heroes and poets, saints and ghosts, they're all there. Until 1861, when Garibaldi dispossessed and shot a random sample of them."
Poldy nodded. After all, she had seen the leopard with Claudia Cardinale and Alain Delon some 20 times.
"Everything has to change so that everything can stay the same,"
she said, quoting from the film. For the surviving Belfiores, however, change had meant growing more impoverished from generation to generation, and to prevent their old house from succumbing to the forces of gravity, selling off land bit by bit, and, mon Dieu, taking up middle-class professions.
"I'll bet some of them still haunt this place,"
Poldy said, contemplating the portrait of a particularly disconsolate-looking ancestor.
"Mon Dieu, and how?"
Since her German-Bavarian-Italian visitor was so obviously taken with the house, Valérie showed Poldy the adjoining wine cellar. An airless vault containing a big wine press of age-old oak, various brick basins for the fermenting must, and some old wooden casks in which a grown man could have stood upright.
"This was where the dowser detected the focus of the positive energy. It must be ages since any wine was made here, though."
Poldy indicated the dusty casks and rubbish and mattresses piled up behind the press.
"A sad waste of all that positive energy." "Oui. Mon Dieu, said Valerie. Originally, this was all a wine-growing area. The Ricey di Belfiore's only lived in Femina Morta once a year at harvest time. At the end of the 19th century, there was an earthquake that brought half the ceilings down. My great-great-grandfather promptly quit the house for fear it would collapse, and he never set foot in it again. Nobody did so for a century after that. Then, in the 1970s, my father inspected the place and found it was relatively intact. All the earthquake did was dislodge some plaster.
And the wine?
Valerie shook her head. After the Risorgimento, the Belfioris gradually sold everything off, just to avoid having to do any work.
Poldi learnt that Valerie had inherited the little estate from her father, who had left her mother shortly after her birth.
They loved and hated each other. That kind of incandescent passion will destroy any relationship.
An amour fou, remarked Poldi,
who knew a thing or two about such matters, thinking of my Uncle Pepe.
I hardly knew my father, but when I heard he was leaving me this place, I thought it was time I got to know him. So I learned Italian and moved here. But, mon Dieu, we were going to have some coffee.
In the drawing room, some decrepit armchairs covered in faded upholstery were clustered around a coffee table piled high with a mixture of old tomes and tattered paperbacks. There were books everywhere, on the tables, in bookcases, in display cabinets, and in the library, which, said Valerie, dated from the 18th century. She produced some stale biscuits and an espresso so awful that Poldi marginally improved its taste with the contents of her hip flask. Valerie helped herself to 5 spoonfuls of sugar. Poldi was finding her more and more likable. Femina Morta, she learnt, was all that remained of the Ricey di Belfiore's once immense estate. In order to hang on to the house and keep the wolf from the door, Valerie rented the unused rooms to holidaymakers.
Most of the surrounding land belongs to Russo.
Poldi pricked up her ears.
Do you know him?
Mon Dieu, I certainly do. He's been trying for years to talk me into selling Femina Morta.
Is he married?
Divorced. He has a grown-up daughter who's about to get married.
Valerie laughed.
We have quite a stable relationship, actually, though lately he's taken to adopting drastic measures. Did you notice the lion gardon at the entrance?
Yes, but its twin is missing.
It certainly is. Russo denies it, but I know, of course, that he's behind its disappearance. An unmistakable warning that he's running out of patience.
Valerie sprang to her feet abruptly.
But what am I doing, chattering away like this? Would you like to see another room before you decide? You can stay as long as you want. We'll agree on the rent in due course.
Poldi suddenly remembered the original reason for her presence and realized that it had been misunderstood.
I came looking for Valentino, actually. Valentino Candela. Does the name mean anything to you?
Valerie looked at Poldi for a moment, as if she needed to adjust the focus of her gaze in order to see her visitor in a new light.
Of course,
she said cautiously.
Valentino. A good-looking fellow. Works for Russo, but he sometimes helps me in the house and garden.
He's been missing for 3 days.
Valerie looked dismayed.
Mon Dieu. Now that you mention it, I haven't seen him for quite some time. On Monday, he told me he had something to do at Femina Morta that evening.
Valerie thought for a moment, then firmly shook her head.
Not here, he didn't. I'm absolutely positive.
Poldi handed her the tessera she'd pocketed at the Candelas. Valerie merely shrugged and handed it back.
Very pretty. But what's it got to do with Valentino?
Poldi rolled the piece of mosaic around in her palm.
I don't know.
Then, enlivened by coffee, brandy, and an abundance of positive energy, she had an idea.
But I'd like to ask Signor Russo, preferably without having to give him much prior notice.
I doubt if he'll see you.
Valerie suddenly smiled again.
But I can show you a shortcut to his office building.
The narrow path that ascended a gentle slope from Valerie's garden traversed a small almond orchard before skirting a football pitch and a vegetable garden. Poldi could already make out the chunky, sand-coloured administration block bearing Russo's logo. Beyond it were rows and rows of palm trees on parade, and, further away still, Etna. The setting sun had already imparted a pink and violet tinge to the volcano's plume of smoke, but it was still hot. After the cool interior of Valerie's house, Poldi had broken out in a sweat again, and perspiration was daubing grey shadows on her white caftan. Never a great walker at the best of times, my aunt cursed the heat and the dust that was ruining her slip-ons and besmirching the caftan up to knee-height. To crown everything, two dogs, two scruffy mongrels, came lolloping towards her, barking furiously. My aunt Poldi was fond of dogs, especially little mongrels with pug faces and loud voices, so she couldn't resist clapping her hands and calling out,
"Well, well, well, what's all this, then?"
Which, in mongrel speak, meant,
"Yes, that's right. You're welcome to jump up and scrabble me with your dirty paws."
The 2 months, which needed no second bidding, left big black smears of volcanic soil, humus, and dust on her caftan. Then, before Poldi could curse, they scampered off in search of rats and more adventures. Dusty, sweaty, and grimy, Poldi was promptly intercepted in the lobby of Russo's palm tree empire by 2 security guards in black tracksuit bottoms and sports shirts, and ushered off the premises.
"Very sorry, Signora, but you need an appointment. Now, nothing to be done without an appointment. Signor Russo's a very busy man. No, you really can't see him without an appointment. No, not even if you have come specially from Germany. Send us an email or phone for an appointment with one of our garden consultants. They'll gladly call on you without obligation and give you an estimate. But you're also welcome to order online. Have a nice evening, Signora."
"I did tell you,"
Valerie sighed when Poldi returned crestfallen to Femina Morta. The 2 mongrels, Oscar and Lady, were good-naturedly rollicking around her and biting each other's tails. Grumpy and thirsty, Poldi flopped down behind the wheel of her Alpha. She badly needed a beer to dispel the frustration and thirst that were warring within her. Valerie came over to the driver's window.
"Do you really think something has happened to Valentino?" "I don't know,"
Poldi grunted wearily.
"I simply want to find him before it does. Know what I mean?"
Valerie nodded.
"But Russo employs more than 100 people. Why should he know where one of his part-timers has got to?"
Poldi was feeling really thirsty now. She needed a beer. Or 2. Or something stronger. Most of all, she wanted it quickly. But she gave Valerie's question some thought.
"You know what it's like when you wake up in the morning and something is troubling you? An almost imperceptible change in the temperature. The wind has veered, the light is different, something is creeping up on you. The ice beneath your feet is creaking softly. Perhaps you had a bad dream that was meant to warn you, but you can't remember it. There's nothing left but this sense of unease that pursues you all day long, whispering unintelligibly in your ear."
Valerie stared at her.
"What I mean is, Valerie..."
The young woman made a dismissive gesture.
"I think I get it. Would you care to accompany me to an informal little serata this evening, Poldi? The host is a cousin of my father's. He's a frightful bore, but his wife Carmela is a fantastic cook. She's recently been doing a show on Channel 5 where she presents clever variations on traditional Sicilian dishes. Isn't there some young man who would give his right arm for the chance to escort you?"
Valerie laughed.
"Maybe I'd sooner go with a woman friend. Besides, Russo is also invited."
Poldi beamed. The serata proved to be rather less free and easy than expected, because the host, Domenico Pastorella di Belfiore, known as Mimi, was a great admirer of the German poet Hölderlin. Chapter 3 tells of Poldi's introduction to Hölderlin, of some less impoverished descendants of the Sicilian Bourbons, and of what there was to eat. In a fit of melancholy, Poldi really lets fly. When she's sober again, she makes an unpleasant discovery and dials the wrong number. Shortly before 9, when Valerie collected Poldi from Torre to chauffeur her to Asci Reale, the French girl was wearing a strapless, figure-hugging black dress and sneakers. Poldi, freshly showered, titivated and discreetly scented, had opted for a flowing, very low-cut red silk fantasy adorned with gold dragons, invested with a tasteful exclamation mark by an enamel yin and yang pendant. Quite unnecessarily, it should be added, but having been a costume designer, she ought to know. "A woman's supreme rule for success in business," she told me later, "is, when the chips are down, show plenty of cleavage."
"Uh-huh," I said, unconvinced.
"Aha, be buggered. I was a costume designer with Bavaria Films, and I should know. Get this, you, with your ripped jeans and navy blue sports shirts, always overdress. That's what matters in life, get it? Always overdress. Karl Lagerfeld told me that. It's an old theatrical rule. Moderation is a sign of weakness. Get that into your fat head."
I think she only meant me well, even when she made me wear those Indian cravats that had belonged to my Uncle Pepe. Style-wise, though, I was on a different planet.
"You're always well-dressed in a sports shirt," I said defensively.
I'm quoting Dad.
"Except, my boy, that your father had genuine style and personality."
She really did mean me well.
Valerie drove her Fiat Panda like a Formula One Ferrari. She roared along the winding Provinciale, headlights blazing, sounding her horn before every bend, and seeming to consider the use of brakes a symptom of nervous debility. My Auntie Poldi, no longer sober and rather hungry, clung to the grab handle and tried to breathe calmly.
"The Pastorella branch of the Belfiores is the only one that wasn't strapped for cash after 1861,
Valerie said blithely.
"Uncle Mimi hasn't had to do a regular day's work in his life. He's been writing a book about Herdeline for the past 30 years.
"Good for him," groaned Poldi.
Valerie described her uncle as a Leone di Cancello, or Paper Tiger. Poldi, rather preoccupied with trying not to faint, gathered only that Mimi's great-grandfather had managed to do some kind of deal with Garibaldi that stripped the Pastorellas of only half their assets, roughly the equivalent of half Bavaria and all its castles. Since then, the Pastorella di Belfiores had survived by selling off the remains of their estates. A parcel of land here, a vineyard there, a country house here, a cottage there, a hectare here, a hectare there. There was enough to spare. By Valerie's reckoning, the sheer quantity of land and buildings would suffice for another generation. Then it would be finita la commedia. But since Mimi and Carmela were childless, they had no need to concern themselves with questions like the finite nature of natural resources. Mimi much preferred to think of Herdeline, or better still, to pontificate about Herdeline, preferably to unexpected German guests. However, Poldi didn't know that at this stage. The drive ended in the centre of Asci Reale. Just behind a cathedral, plastered with advertising posters, was a high but unremarkable wall, with a plain iron gate set in it. Paved with basalt cobblestones, the narrow one-way street was barely wide enough for a car and only dimly illuminated by isolated sodium lights, not a place Poldi would have associated with Baroque splendour. But Valerie rang the bell beside the iron gate, which automatically opened at once. Even Poldi caught her breath for a moment at the sight of what lay beyond it. Immediately inside was a formal garden with neatly manicured hedges, flower beds, and an illuminated fountain.
Mimi claims that Goethe spent the night here on his tour of Italy and wrote a poem about it.
Don't ask me which one. He's bound to tell you. An avenue of carefully espaliered orange trees lit by LED floodlights culminated in a U-shaped Baroque country house, which was also bathed in bluish radiance by ground-mounted floodlights. As if that were not enough, big torches were burning on either side of the entrance. Poldi was amazed at how secluded this mansion was.
Unlike Femina Morta, however, it had about as much charm as the Iper Simpli car park. She also doubted whether Goethe had really overnighted or written a poem there. But Herdeline, not Goethe, was the prevailing spirit in the Pastorella household, and Poldi encountered him as soon as she crossed the threshold. She glimpsed the shadowy form out of the corner of her eye as it almost soundlessly darted towards her out of the gloom. My aunt was fond of dogs, as I've said, with one exception. Dogs with sharp muscles, slit eyes and bat-like ears, long-legged, glossy black packets of muscle. Poldi considered them the embodiment of malignity. The Doberman suddenly materialized in front of her. An adult male with enormous balls, it came up almost to her chest. Its growl was so spine-chilling that Poldi's scream died in her throat, and all that emerged was a strangled squeak. She stood rooted to the spot. So did Valerie, but she recovered herself in an instant.
"Shush, you brute!" she cried. "Shush, Herdeline! Piss off!"
The Doberman had no intention of doing so. On the contrary, it bared still more of its immaculate teeth and tensed its muscles in readiness to spring at their throats. Poldi felt sure her time had come, and for one brief moment she found that prospect a lousy idea.
"But you don't mind dying of cirrhosis of the liver, eh?" I blurted out later when she was telling me the whole story.
"Now you're talking like Teresa. You don't know the meaning of genuine despair. Carry on, I'm listening." "No, you aren't. You keep on interrupting me. You were like that as a boy. Know what your father said to me once? It was lucky you didn't speak better Italian, or you'd talk us into the ground. So why are we sitting here, then?" "Because hope is the last thing to die," said my aunt.
Which brought us back to the subject of death, hope, and Herdeline.
"Herdeline, sit."
Salvation appeared in the shape of a white-haired gentleman with slender hands, dainty gestures, and a mellifluous voice. Herdeline responded to his command as if Jupiter himself had spoken. He throttled back his growls from volume 10 to 3, lowered his bat-like ears, and meekly sat down on his huge balls.
"Beg your pardon, my dears," the master of the house said softly, fondling the Doberman's head. "Herdeline is in his Sturm und Drang mode, but he's really such a sensitive soul."
Mimi kissed Valerie lightly on both cheeks before turning his full attention to Poldi, or rather, to her cleavage.
"You must be Donna Isolde," he said in German, and kissed her hand. "Delighted to make your acquaintance."
"Poldi, plain Poldi," replied my aunt,
who was gradually recovering her habitual composure.
"But how mundane that sounds for such a..." Mimi gulped. "For a beauty such as yourself, signora, where have you sprung from?"
"Torre Achirafi, via Munich."
"Ah, Munich isn't far from Herdeline's Tübingen, is it?"
"Just around the corner, so to speak."
Mimi beamed at Poldi and offered her his arm.
"Are you fond of Herdeline?"
Poldi squinted at the Doberman, which was just trotting off with a blasé air.
"Well, we've had a rather difficult relationship up to now."
"Trust me, Donna Isolde, I shall open your eyes to a new cosmos."
Without paying any more attention to Valerie, Mimi led my auntie Poldi into the house and introduced her to his wife. Carmela looked a good 30 years younger than him, but Poldi wasn't entirely sure because she'd obviously had a few things tweaked. Her retroussé nose, slightly bee-stung lips, and host of dimples didn't really go with her otherwise classically Greek physiognomy. Her nails were perfectly manicured, her figure was eloquent of great self-discipline, and she spread her fingers every time she gestured, activating a whole orchestra of bangles, chains, and earrings. Poldi's idea of a hands-on cook had been rather different. What a day it had been, she thought. Relieved to catch sight of a young Moroccan in red livery padding around with a tray of colourful aperitivi, as if duty-bound to protect them, she made a beeline for him. Having sunk 2 in quick succession, Poldi took a 3rd to be on the safe side, and then felt sufficiently refreshed and fortified to cope with the rest of the evening. Enchanted by his unexpected German guest with a spectacular bosom, Mimi led her around, patted her hand, squinted down her décolleté, and introduced her in a whisper to the dozen-odd guests who had already assembled in the drawing-room. Bent-backed old gentlemen in grey suits, and tiny, elegantly dressed ladies, most of whom were the wrong side of 80. The sight of them reminded Poldi irresistibly of dried figs and candied fruit. However, the main focus of her attention was the man facing her, who never took his eyes off Valerie. My aunt had pictured Italo Russo quite differently. More like the typical greasy mafioso familiar from movies and TV, with a pot belly, pencil moustache, and oily hair, wearing shirt sleeves and braces. Uncle Martino had told her that slovenly dress was part of the typical mafia look, and that the bosses of Cosa Nostra made a point of neglecting their outward appearance in the extreme. But I think that's just a post-war myth. Poldi was, in fact, confronted by a tanned, good-looking man wearing jeans and an orange sports shirt. He was in his mid-50s, with no tummy to speak of, but was shaven-headed and endowed with a pair of pale, darting, lizard-like eyes that missed nothing and radiated serene self-confidence. It was as if Russo owned the house and everything in it, or would very soon do so. Despite herself, Poldi couldn't help picturing him in police uniform. The other guests and Mimi treated Russo with the utmost respect, but one of them overdid it. A man in his mid-40s, he bore a closer resemblance to Poldi's mafioso stereotype. Swarthy, ill-shaven, thick-set, collar sprinkled with scurf. He munched grissini and nuts the whole time, picked his teeth with his thumbnail, and followed Russo around like a dog.
"Who's that greasy character?"
Poldi asked Valerie in a whisper.
"Corrado Patinet, a building contractor from Riposto. Why is he fawning over Russo like that?"
Valerie shrugged.
"Probably hoping for a contract if Russo expands his empire further. Smarmy but harmless."
Instinct told Poldi otherwise, but she pushed between the two men and shook Russo by the hand.
"Well, what a coincidence, the two of us meeting here. I needn't have gone to the trouble of getting myself so rudely ejected by your gorillas this afternoon when I asked to see you."
Russo grasped her hand and looked her keenly in the eye.
"I'm sorry if you had any unpleasantness, but we maintain strict security measures."
"In case someone runs off with a palm tree?"
He smiled.
"What did you wish to speak to me about?"
"I simply want to know where Valentino is. Valentino Candela, who works for you."
"Ah, yes. You're the German Signora Valentina sometimes goes shopping for, aren't you? Delighted to meet you in person. Valentina's a great admirer of yours."
"Oh, did he tell you that? Then you surely must know where he is."
Russo remained calm. If he was nervous, he didn't betray it by so much as the bat of an eyelash.
"I'm afraid I'll have to disappoint you there, Signora. Valentino hasn't turned up for work for the last 3 days. My foreman called his parents, and they've no idea of his whereabouts either. But, bene, if he doesn't want to work, no one's forcing him."
"You sound a little piqued."
Russo smiled again.
"Valentino is a boy with a lot of potential. Shame he isn't a bit more reliable."
That appeared to conclude the conversation, as far as he was concerned, because he turned back to Patinet, who was standing beside Poldi and eyeing her nervously.
"Perhaps you know the whereabouts of Femina Morta's missing lion?"
Poldi persisted, but Russo seemed equally unperturbed by this question. He merely turned to Valerie with a look of surprise.
"Is one missing, signorina? That's most regrettable."
And that was the end of that, because Carmela clapped her hands and said,
"Dinner is served."
Instantly, like stampeding cattle, the guests trooped into the dining room. Mimi seized Poldi's hand and gallantly steered her to the head of the table.
"Sit beside me, Donna Isolde. I must tell you all about my hurdling biography."
Poldi saw Patinet practically barge an elderly lady aside in order to sit next to Russo, She would have liked to continue questioning the latter, but she had no chance to do so for the next 2 hours, which were devoted to food. The menu? Risotto ai fiori d'arancio? Timbalo di pasta ripieno di ragù? Frittata di mascolini? Caponata? Sorbetto di olio d'oliva? Involtini di pesce spada? Sarde a beccafico su finocchio selvatico? Cassata della nonna? Formaggi e profumi della Sicilia. Meanwhile, two liveried Moroccans tirelessly bore in trays, terrines, and dishes, as if producing them from some subterranean, inexhaustible cornucopia of delicacies. Involuntarily reminded of the effort it cost her to slave over a simple leg of roast pork, Poldi was filled with admiration for Carmela, who had cooked this all, yet looked as fresh as a spray of orange blossom at dawn. 12 guests, as already mentioned, but food for 30. The wine, however, sufficed for only 4. This aroused a certain measure of dissatisfaction in my aunt, though she did find it amusing when four-legged Herdaline stuck his head in Rousseau's crotch and refused to budge. Rousseau didn't budge either. "I've had Dobermans for 50 years, Mimi whispered to Baldy, "and I named each of them Herdaline." "A form of immortality in itself," she said, before she could stop herself. Valerie nearly choked. Mimi clapped his hands in delight. "Bravo, Donna Isolde! At last a kindred spirit who can see into the depths of my heart!" Herdaline-wise, this dispelled the last of Mimi's modesty and restraint. Forza Herdaline. Herdaline ruled the waves. Leaning over Poldi like a junk in a gale, Mimi spent the whole evening raving to her about his idol from Tübingen, recited his hymns, patriotic poems, and Hyperion, and expatiated on the poet's insanity, which Mimi disputed, his many years of seclusion in a tower, and the Masonic conspiracy that lay, in Mimi's view, at the root of this. "I can prove, Donna Isolde, that Herdaline's poems reveal arcane knowledge of great antiquity. Encoded, of course, Herdaline was not only the greatest German poet, but also a cryptological genius. I'm on the verge of deciphering his code, and thus of revealing a truth that will shake the world to its foundations." "Is there any more wine anywhere?" Poldi cried out in despair, wondering what the hell she was doing there. Mimi continued to blather incessantly. The other guests looked relieved to be able to concentrate entirely on their dinner. Beside her, Valerie merely picked at her food for form's sake and did her best to ignore Rousseau, who spent the whole time eyeing her across the table. Unable to get properly drunk on such a paucity of wine, Poldi couldn't help wondering what, if anything, had gone on between them. Paternay, who never took his eyes off Rousseau for a moment, munched, chewed, grunted, sighed, and belched without a break, spoke to nobody else, and took not the slightest trouble to feign polite interest in the other guests. When inebriation simply refused to supervene for lack of wine, my aunt became first sentimental and then melancholy. A familiar shadow descended on her soul like a heavy velvet curtain beneath which one could sleep or suffocate. Preferably both. Poldi thought of her Pepe, of John, of the house in Tanzania, of all the people, things, and hopes she had lost, of the countless times she had stuck in her oar and ruined everything. She thought of Valentino, who was very probably in bed with some girl, and it seemed to her that today had been nothing but a bloody, awful, shitty waste of time. She heard Mimi's voice beside her. He had risen to his feet and was declaiming a Herdaline poem, first in German and then in his own Italian translation. It ended, "Naught am I now, my love of life is gone." The words pierced Poldi to the core. Direct hit, sunk. She felt Valerie's hand on her arm.
"Poldi, everything all right?"
"Of course. Why shouldn't it be?"
"You're crying."
"No, I'm not."
"You most certainly are. You're trembling."
Poldi noticed only then that everyone was staring at her, and that Valerie was holding out a handkerchief.
"Thanks,"
she sniffed. She blew her nose and promptly felt a trifle better. She turned to Valerie.
"Would you mind driving me home, please?"
So much for that evening. In order to draw a line under it, Poldi spent the whole of the following day lying in her darkened bedroom in the Via Baronessa with a bottle of vodka, drinking and wallowing in self-pity. She heard children romping around and neighbours chatting, heard laughter and squabbles, the blatting of vespers and the babble of quiz shows, heard the sea murmur and the day expire with a long, exhausted sigh. She didn't go out, didn't answer the door, didn't answer the phone, she just drank, hoping that her liver and heart would soon give out and finally shut up shop. But they didn't. They simply soldiered on. They knew better. Having boozed for a day and a night, my Auntie Poldi was promptly afflicted with insomnia because her liver was working overtime to metabolize all the alcohol. Thanks to that and a full bladder, she was roused between 3 and 4 in the morning by a recurrence of thirst, which assailed her like an angry, neglected lover. Poldi would normally have taken half a diazepam and slept till noon, but this morning she didn't. She'd been woken by a dream accompanied by an ugly metallic noise, but she couldn't remember what it was about, only that a heavy, immovable shadow had been resting on her chest. Restlessly, she tossed and turned in her bed, but drank only water and took 2 aspirin, then got up shakily and made herself some coffee. She ate 2 slices of toast, watered the plants in the courtyard, and ate another 2 slices of toast. The trembling and the aftermath of the nightmare were slow to subside. At around 5, in the first pale light of dawn, she couldn't stand it any longer. She got dressed and drove to Priola to toss a pretty pebble into the sea in memory of Pepe, and perhaps to have a little dip in the light of the rising sun. Her plan came to nothing. She caught sight of the figure as soon as she parked the car. Seemingly poured out like liquid on the rounded volcanic rocks, it was just a shadow in the half-light, just a dark patch forgotten by the sea like jetsam. Not a sound to be heard but the buzzing of flies and the splash of wavelets on the shore, as if the sea itself were not yet properly awake. Somehow, Poldi already guessed what had woken her, and what she would very soon see. Cautiously, but resolutely, she made her way over the big, rounded boulders and approached the figure on the beach as if loath to wake its owner. He was so young, after all, and young men need plenty of sleep.
"Valentino?"
Her voice sounded hoarse, like the mewing of a kitten. Valentino was lying stretched out on his back. Poldi recognized him at once by the trinacria tattooed on his left forearm, the Sicilian symbol consisting of a 3-legged gorgon's head. She wouldn't, however, have been able to recognize him by his handsome Arabo-Norman face, because someone had blown that away at short range with a lupara, a sawn-off shotgun. When Poldi came nearer, a cloud of flies rose from the remains of his head. With a groan, she knelt down beside him, just crouched beside the corpse, whimpering softly as if that age-old song of grief could bring him back to life. The big pebbles hurt her knees, but she scarcely felt the pain. She grasped his left hand, which was as cold and hard and dry as the stones on the beach.
"Oh, Valentino, why did you never say a word?"
She fondled his cold hand and stared at the sea and the rising sun to avoid having to look at him. It wasn't her first dead body, and she wasn't easily shocked, but the sight of that mangled face affected her deeply. She turned her head away and tried to concentrate on his hand, on his dirty fingernails and the familiar tattoo. At length, however, she forced herself to look.
"That was when I made Valentino a promise,"
she told me later.
"An almost automatic process was at work, that's why. It was genetically conditioned."
"You mean a kind of criminalistic hereditary reflex?" I asked, remembering the psychology course I dropped out of.
Bullshit. It was the hunting instinct.
She looked at me.
Either you've got it or you haven't.
Valentino's face looked really awful. The eyes, nose and mouth were scarcely distinguishable, just a gory mush of shredded flesh and bone fragments. But Poldi took a careful look in spite of the flies and her urge to vomit. The blood had already congealed. She carefully raised the head a little, then gently laid it down again. After hesitating for a moment, she drew a deep breath. Poldi bravely felt in his trouser pockets. The left-hand pocket yielded nothing but some reddish grains of sand, but in the other she found a few coins, and among them a little piece of mosaic like the one she had purloined from his bedroom. A glazed, cobalt-blue ceramic fragment the size of a cent. After a moment's thought, she pocketed the tessera and stuffed the small change back in Valentino's trouser pocket. She didn't find his mobile phone. Poldi knew it was time to call the police, but first she examined the immediate vicinity of the corpse. Not until the sun had almost climbed above the skyline did she return on trembling legs to the car, where she'd left her mobile, and dial 112. Which meant that she had misdialed in her agitated state of mind, because instead of calling the Polizia di Stato, who answer to 113 and are responsible for homicide, she had called the Carabinieri, who are only semi-responsible for such cases. The Italian state maintains a Babylonian multiplicity of police forces. Polizia di Stato, Carabinieri, Guardia di Finanza, Polizia Penitenziaria, Corpo Forestale dello Stato, Guardia Costiera, Polizia Municipale, Poldi's Vigili Urbani, the Presidential Corazzieri, Polizia Provinciale, and Polizia Locale, plus various special units dedicated to combating terrorism and the mafia and protecting the state, nearly all of them subordinate to different ministries. They almost defy comprehension, except, of course, by Poldi with her lifelong expert knowledge of uniformed masculinity. The Carabinieri, or Italian Gendarmerie, tend to operate more in rural districts and are nationally reputed to be a catch-all for village idiots and knuckleheads in general. This may be to do with their full-dress uniform, which would grace an operetta with its silver epaulettes, scarlet-lined cape and monstrous bicorn hat, the lucerna. The Carabinieri will accept anyone, so it's said, which is why they are the favourite butt of schoolboy jokes. One classic example, why do Carabinieri always patrol in threes? Well, one can read, one can write, and a third is to keep an eye on that pair of dangerous intellectuals. An absolute scream, no? Or this one. Two Carabinieri are on guard in the street. One says, "Look, a dead seagull." The other looks up at the sky and says, "Where?" But this is all malicious nonsense, of course, because the Italian police are no less professional than those of any other country. It should be pointed out that the Carabinieri are in competition with the Polizia di Stato. Actually, it's a nice democratic idea to protect the country from an overly powerful police force by getting one type of police to keep a check on the other. Except that it leads in practice to squabbles, arguments over spheres of responsibility, and delays. This was precisely what happened on the beach at Priola, because soon afterwards Poldi noticed her mistake and dialed 113 as well. 10 minutes later, an Alfa Romeo zoomed up and out jumped two Carabinieri in dark blue uniforms with snappy red stripes on their trousers. The older of the two had wrinkled, careworn features. The other, who looked as young as a new-laid egg, had plucked eyebrows and a neat fringe of beard adorning the edge of his jaw. Poldi, who had retired to her car, gave them a weary wave.
"Was it you who called us?"
yelled the older man.
"Yes,"
she indicated the shore.
"His name is Valentino Candela."
She watched the young policeman picking his way over the boulders.
"Your colleague should be careful not to trample on any clues."
She saw the youngster bend over the body and recoil in horror, then put his hands over his face and turn away.
Oh, my God, he called. Madonna, how frightful.
The older policeman looked irresolute for a moment. Then, after glancing in turn at his horrified colleague and the bewigged woman in the old Alpha with the Munich license plates, he reached for his holster.
Kindly get out of the car, Signora, very slowly.
I'm sorry?
You heard me.
Well, surely you don't think I...
I won't say it again, he said,
and then he did.
Get out!
With a sigh, Poldi got out with her hands raised, one of them holding her ID. She remained standing beside the car.
Step away from the car, Signora. Good, that'll do.
That was just how I found him lying there.
Name?
I told you, Valentino Candela.
No, your name.
Isolde Oberreiter.
German?
The young policeman was tottering back across the beach. Poldi saw he was weeping. She felt sorry for him. Yes, German, but resident in Torre Acchirafi. The young officer stared at her while the older man peered into her car.
When did you find the deceased?
30 minutes ago.
And what were you doing here all on your own?
I came for a swim.
What? At this hour?
I'm German. We do these kinds of things. The two carabinieri seemed to think this made sense. They checked Poldi's ID and carefully noted down her name, letter by letter, and likewise the license number of her car. She was just about to ask them whether it wasn't high time they sent for forensics and informed homicide, when a Polizia di Stato Fiat came roaring up, and the whole performance was repeated from scratch. Two officers got out, one younger than the other. The former shuffled down to the shore and inspected the corpse, reacted accordingly, and returned in tears. In the meantime, the older man sparred with his carabinieri colleague.
Franco, what the devil are you two comedians doing here?
I might ask you the same question, Pippo.
We received a call.
So did we.
Did you call us, Signora?
Yes.
You see, you two losers can push off. This case is ours.
What number did you call, Signora? 112 or 113?
Both.
Both?
Dismayed silence.
Holy shit.
So what now?
The four policemen stared uneasily at Valentino's mutilated body.
No problem, said the older state policeman. You were here first. We'll beat it.
Hey, not so fast, Pippo. You can have the case.
Oh, sure, that would suit you fine, wouldn't it? Okay, Marco, let's go.
Beckoning to his young colleague, the older state policeman turned to go.
She knows the murder victim,
cried the older carabiniere, pointing to my aunt. The state policeman spun round and stared intently at Poldi, as if to show the carabinieri how to launch a preliminary attack.
Did you shoot him, Signora?
No.
Well, how did you know who he was?
By the tattoo on his arm.
Uh-huh. And where did you know him from?
Valentino. His name is Valentino Candela. He helped me in the house occasionally. He'd been missing for 4 days.
Oh, I see. And what were you doing down on the beach so early?
Going for a swim.
A swim? She's German. Oh, I see.
A pensive silence.
A fine mess, eh, Pippo?
You could call it that.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
Yes. Haven't seen anything like this since 1988.
Did you touch anything, Signora?
I held his hand.
You did what?
Held his hand.
Why the devil did you do that?
Because I felt sorry for him. Even Pippo and Franco seemed to find this logical. The two younger policemen didn't utter a sound. Still in shock, they stood there smoking while their elders conferred.
We must call forensics and homicide.
Yours or ours?
Both.
Irresolutely, they stared out to sea past Valentino's corpse.
What a mess.
It's just like 1988.
What was his name?
Valentino Candela.
No, I meant in 1988.
Toto Scarfidi.
Toto the Butcher, that's right. Horrible business. With a lupara, too. Blood everywhere.
Poldi surmised that she wasn't needed for the moment. Somewhat tremulous and suffering from a slight headache, she went back to her car. She badly needed a drink.
You realize, Signora, that you may have disturbed a lot of evidence.
This wasn't the crime scene in any case,
Poldi said irritably,
as I'm sure you've noticed. Only the perp could know that,
cried Marco, the young state policeman, and the two older officers instinctively reached for their guns.
Stand still.
Don't move, Signora.
Oh, pipe down, laddie,
Poldi growled in German, adding in Italian,
I'm going home now. I've had enough. You've got my address and everything.
You're going nowhere. You're a murder suspect.
I can echo these two,
my Auntie Poldi told me later.
Like a crotchety old married couple. You know, sometimes I'm glad Beppe and I didn't grow old together. When I look at couples like that, I'd sooner have topped myself.
She reached for the whiskey bottle, but I jerked it back out of range.
So you were suspected of murder,
I said to distract her.
What happened next? Well, the dickhead simply kept me there till homicide arrived, which turned out to be an advantage in the long run.
Because that was how you got to know Montana.
You're always so impatient. If the stories you write are as breathless, you mustn't be surprised if your readers get stressed and give up. Calm equals strong in sex as in art.
All styles are good except the boring kind, I lectured in return. Voltaire. Poldi took a pull at her drink and gave me a long look.
You don't believe me, eh? You think I'm lying. You think I made it all up, don't you?
No, I didn't think that. And even if I had, what then?
So, you were a murder suspect,
I said. Chapter 4 describes how Poldi is questioned by a detective chief inspector with beautiful eyes and demonstrates that she herself is an expert detective. Rumours take shape in Torre Akirafi, and Poldi forms a preliminary suspicion. Subtle eroticism notwithstanding, the policeman proves to be a tough nut. Poldi jousts with death, reaches a decision, and receives an initial clue to the murder motive. It quickly became hot on the beach at Priola. Poldi continued to sit in her car, cocooned in a bubble of heat, stupidity, and fluttering scene of crime tape. Sweating, she watched men in paper overalls cordoning off the beach, spraying marks on rocks, planting little flags, and taking photographs. All these procedures were carried out as slowly as if they were taking place on a peak in the Himalayas. The forensic medical examiner scraped something from beneath Valentino's fingernails, dropped it, looked for it feverishly, and rediscovered it on a rock. Peering around with a furtive air, he hurriedly inserted it in a glass vial. Poldi sighed. Having been familiar with the course of police investigations from an early age, she waited patiently for homicide to arrive so that she could finally dispel any misunderstandings and be permitted to drive home. But they took their time. Instead, more carabinieri and state police turned up to keep the first inquisitive spectators at bay, or simply to chat together and cast suspicious glances at my aunt. The approaches to the beach became choked with patrol cars. No one brought Poldi any water or asked her any more questions, not even the two young policemen who had detailed to guard her and had confiscated her car key for safety's sake. They simply stared at her and left her to sweat.
"You might at least give me a cigarette, boys."
After exchanging a glance, the young pups eventually offered her an MS. From their manner, she might have been a prisoner on death row. Poldi shut her eyes against the sun and smoked, thinking of Valentino and her brief preliminary investigation, which seemed to indicate that she was the last person to see Valentino alive, apart, of course, from the murderer. A shadow fell across her face.
Signora Oberreiter?
A man in a pale grey suit was standing beside the car. Possibly a trifle short for Poldi's taste, he was wearing the grumpy expression of someone attempting to give up smoking. The beginnings of a tummy, but thoroughly fit in other respects. Aquiline nose, dark hair not cut too short, a face like a Greek god cast in bronze, beard and moustache flecked with grey, a face devoid of fatigue. An angry little furrow between the eyebrows, offset by laughter lines around the eyes. Hands like a pianist's, slender but strong, with the curving thumbs indicative of willpower. Poldi was something of an expert on these things.
"My name is Vito Montana. I'm heading this investigation."
The man held up his ID card. Poldi saw a passport photo and the words Commissario Capo, a detective chief inspector.
"I should like to ask you some questions."
"What outfit do you belong to, Commissario?"
"State Police."
The Commissario indicated Poldi's alpha.
"I used to have one of these."
"I didn't kill Valentino."
Montana nodded as if this had long ceased to be an issue.
"Any idea who it could have been?"
Poldi shook her head and eyed Montana's hands.
"Ring?"
asked my Aunt Teresa, pragmatic as usual, when Poldi gave her a detailed description of this first encounter.
"Absolutely not. And his eyes," sighed Poldi. "Bright green and always on the move, but quite unlike Russo's. Not so predatory. More observant, more receptive. You know, more interesting."
Teresa, Caterina, and Luisa nodded. They knew a thing or two about beautiful eyes. But Poldi immediately detected something else in the inspector's eyes. Profound sorrow, despite the laughter lines that belied his grumpy manner. She put him in his late 50s. So by no means too young for her. And although he wasn't, alas, in uniform, one thing was clear from the start. The man appealed to her. This was also the moment when a kind of hunger, a painful ferment in her epicenter, spread rapidly and set everything ablaze.
"You come from Munich?"
"I'm sorry?"
"You're from Munich?"
Yes, originally. But I live at 29 Via Baronessa in Torre Achirafi. I must change the registration on my car."
She surreptitiously adjusted her wig, squinting in the rearview mirror and cursing herself for not wearing any makeup.
"What brought you to Sicily?"
"Love,"
she said spontaneously, and Montana smiled. He produced a small notebook and turned over a page. To Poldi's regret, she could no longer see his eyes.
"You were acquainted with Valentino Candela?"
"He sometimes ran errands for me."
"And you come here to swim every day?"
"For my figure's sake. I'm not 20 anymore. That's to say no, not every day."
"But today?"
Montana made a note with his strong, willpower-laden hands.
"Why do you believe this isn't the scene of the crime?"
"Heavens, surely you must have noticed."
"Noticed what?"
"Well, there's hardly any blood beneath his head, and none round about either. There'd have to have been blood everywhere with a killing like this. Like the Toto Scafidi case."
Montana looked up from his notebook. Much to Poldi's regret, he wasn't smiling anymore.
"You think this murder is somehow connected to that of Toto Scafidi?"
Poldi sighed.
"That was just an incidental remark."
"Perhaps you'd better refrain from making incidental remarks, Signora. Did you remove anything from the victim's body or its immediate vicinity?"
Poldi stared at the cobalt-blue piece of mosaic that had been lying, clearly visible, on the dusty dashboard all this time, like a little jewel. She resisted the impulse to pick it up, but only with the greatest self-control.
"No."
Montana looked out across the beach, thinking hard.
Perhaps Valentino was killed near the water's edge and deposited further up later on. The tide would have washed all the blood away.
Unlikely, said Poldy.